So this will be about strategies for reducing the climate change problem, and I'm going to use the flip chart a little bit more here to put some of your knowledge up on the board here and evaluate some of the possible strategies. Some of the background outline first, current state of carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, different energy sources, pros and cons of some of the traditional sources versus alternatives, and what kind of historical policies have led us to the state of energy demand and CO2 concentrations that we have now, and what are some policy options and issues of global coordination in trying to reduce the increase in CO2 concentration. So this is what's known as the Keeling curve. It's the longest longest time series from any station of the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. So it started in 1957 and goes up to the present day. The original person who compiled this the first part of this time series is named Charles Keeling, and he was with the Scripps Institute for Oceanography, and that's their logo on the left. And this is now maintained by, I had to put this on here, it's a triple acronym, NOAA ESRL GMD, which is National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Earth System Research Laboratory, Global Monitoring Division. So within the time of this record, the concentration has increased from about 315 parts per million to, it's not going all the way up to the present. I guess it is dated August 2012. But this year we passed the 400 parts per million mark. And actually, what's considered to be the pre-industrial value prior to the Industrial Revolution is 280 parts per million. So we're up to almost one and a half times that much. And the red curve includes the annual wiggle, which is due to the greening up of the northern hemisphere. More of the plant life is in the northern hemisphere, so that actually causes an annual oscillation. The black curve has that averaged out over the year.
So, like you said yesterday, a doubling CO2 is a 2 to 6 degree Celsius jump in temperature, so can we infer that we've gone like 2 or 3 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Well, yeah, it's less than that so far, but predicted to be more in the future. One of the things is that CO2 sensitivity is measured on the basis of once the ocean temperature catches up with the atmospheric temperature, and those are really out of equilibrium and are expected to be. So the equilibrium sensitivity is kind of a fictional construction, but it tells you something about the sensitivity. So these are, as of 2006, per capita carbon dioxide emissions. You see kind of one tier at the top that consists of the US, Canada, and Australia. And these are these represent the sparsely populated first world countries. Then kind of the next tier is the more densely populated industrialized countries, South Korea, Russia, Japan, Germany, United Kingdom, maybe Russia is not that densely populated, but the others are. So actually, anyone want to sort of account for what they think might be the reason for the difference between the United States and the United Kingdom, for example?
Automobiles?
We all have two cars.
There's ammunition manufacturing.
There's more land for like factories and stuff?
Yeah, it's largely a difference in the usage of automobiles as well as the single family versus multi-family dwellings. So yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that.
How do you think that chart might look different 5 years later today?
Yeah, actually, I was going to mention that. And I would say that the main difference would be that China is gaining quite quickly. And even though their per capita amount is still well below the U.S., the total amount, when you multiply by the population, is now greater in China than the U.S.
So it says tons of carbon per capita. That six is 6 tons per person.
Yep. Yeah, so that's carbon. It's somewhat less than, say, the amount of gasoline you're using. Yeah, Max.
Is that carbon or carbon dioxide?
This is measured in terms of carbon, so it's calculated using the molecular or the atomic mass of carbon. So if it's carbon dioxide, you have to divide by that molecular mass and then multiply back by the part that's carbon.
What if airplanes, plane travel would be putting us a lot further than people in this country travel more by plane, take that for granted, and just
right.
Do it all the time?
That's one of the factors, I'm sure. Okay, and then, yeah, what it's listing here is the countries that have the largest total emission. And India makes it into that category, even though its per capita amount is very small.
So I could see the United States, but I don't see Canada and Australia being that high. Not for cars.
Canada is very car dependent.
Is it?
And yeah, very suburban. Yeah, most of their population is kind of along the corridor from Windsor, which is very close to where I live, through to the Montreal and Quebec areas. So, yeah, there are a whole lot of suburban type of living situations along that. Okay, so I guess it was on Monday I mentioned some people that I talked to at a banquet who really wanted not to to believe in the reality of human-caused climate change, and said, well, if it's true, then we'll have to do something, but it's not fair that the United States should have to cut their emissions and other countries not. So I didn't quite have the presence of mind to say, for example, well, what if we required the U.S. to cut their emissions by 25% and China to cut back to the same per capita amount? So, I don't know, they might say, well, that sounds reasonable. But in fact, take the United States, cut it by a quarter, it's about there. China starts here. They're increasing by a factor of 3. So it's a matter of perception, just how fair that is. So maybe countries that have been emitting more need to take more of a burden in reducing the amount. Then this is really an optimistic evaluation of the future that was published in 2004. They call it the stabilization wedges. And they were looking at the amount of carbon dioxide that is being emitted during, well, yeah, again, it's in terms of tons of gigatons of carbon, but how much is being emitted at around 2006, and then projecting out using different methods to increase efficiency and using renewable energy, and then down here, CCS stands for carbon capture and sequestration, and supply efficiency. I'm not quite sure what that is. But this one is saying put these different methods together, and between 2006 and 2056, you've reduced total emissions from 1.6 to 0.6 gigatons of carbon. And that's a reasonable amount that you can say that the concentration in the atmosphere is going to remain stable. So now let's talk about energy sources, and I'm just going to give you a few on the slides, and then maybe we'll throw some ideas up on the flip chart. So this one sort of has source in quotation marks. Energy efficiency, it reduces the energy need and lets you shift around usage of other types of energy supplies. Saves you money. And then cons are what I call white people problems, like I need my SUV to go off road from my garage to my backyard, or I want to keep my water heater at 190 Fahrenheit and then mix it with cold water, something like that. And a lot of people want conspicuous consumption because it's cool. So coal is probably the worst of all worlds, but it's plentiful and cheap in a lot of places. Just convenience of use, it's solid, so it's less convenient to handle. People have gone away from the very old days of shoveling coal into their home stove, but it's still used a whole lot in power plants. Low energy per CO2, that's the problem that contributes to climate change. And there are other significant pollutants, particulates, sulfates, and mercury. Okay, then particularly prompted by Brian's question of yesterday, liquid hydrocarbons, including gasoline, diesel, and LP, their main pro is that they're easy to put in cars and airplanes. They're kind of the most convenient way of fueling those things, and relatively inexpensive, kind of moderate energy per CO2. It's a little better than coal. And occasionally there are spills, a big one in the Gulf of Mexico a few years ago. Produces some other pollutants, nitrous oxide and ozone and particulates. So actually, let's go to the flip chart now and name some other energy sources.
Natural gas.
Okay. What's a pro?
The price is falling.
Okay.
And it has a third less emissions than coal does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, lower CO2 emissions, right?
Yeah.
CO2 per energy. All right.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually got a whole lot less of the things like sulfur and nitrous oxide than some of these other fossil fuels. So what are the problems with
it's not available everywhere.
Okay. Not everywhere.
Fracking.
Yeah. So fracking accounts for a lot of the price reduction in recent times.
Which contaminates water sources.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How about leakage? Yeah, so the main component of natural gas is CH4, which is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2.
Is that methane?
Yes, methane. So maybe somewhat better than coal or oil. Not everything's good though.
Nuclear?
Okay. And I somewhat gave away this answer yesterday in response to a question. So what are pros of nuclear? Nuclear.
It's completely CO2, any emissions free for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get 25 years?
Oh, I don't know. I was just kind of, I guess the whatever the Brent would know, the average age of a nuclear power plant. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I guess I don't really know the number. Once you've built the power plant, you know, if there's a CO2 cost in that, then using the nuclear fuel, there's no CO2 emission at that point.
Are you ready for comments?
new plant designs are incredibly safe.
Okay. Newer, safer plants. Yeah, the existing plants are mostly at least 40 years old. Go ahead, Brian. Cons.
Well, I'm thinking of what happened in Japan with the earthquake.
Okay.
And I don't know all the consequences. I just know that there were some horrible consequences. They're still attempting to deal with.
Have there been any casualties from Fukushima? I don't think there have been.
Yeah, well, it's hard to really quantify the long-term mutagenic properties of the radiation and that sort of thing.
Another good example is Chernobyl in Russia.
Yeah.
And there's been all sorts of birth defects, and they're getting worse, actually, generation after generation.
So we have waste, what do you do with spent fuel rods?
Yep.
Does it need a constant water source? Cooling?
Yeah, it does. So
it takes water from other uses.
Okay. Yeah, I'd call that sort of a minimal effect.
It can be cooled with other things, too. Sodium. And maybe they don't do that anymore.
Max?
A positive is the waste is localized.
Okay.
In the sense that carbon emissions are global, whereas nuclear waste is confined.
Yeah, well, we hope it's confined.
Until the earthquake, yeah.
All right, other sources.
Solar?
All right. I was trying to break this down into solar electricity and solar thermal, but solar thermal was really a niche kind of thing. So advantages and disadvantages of solar.
No CO2.
Right, okay.
It's hopefully free and abundant.
Right. Calling it free real?
Well, free radiation. I know it's not free to build something to make it useful.
Some cost of panels are going down.
Okay.
Of equipment, I suppose.
The cost is going down, but what I've read is that it's still more expensive than other ways of generating electricity,
mm-hmm.
even though the costs are diminishing.
Then you have to define cost.
Yeah, we're going to be getting to extrinsic costs later in the presentation.
Another con is that it requires it to be sunny.
It's not available everywhere.
Okay. Limited locations. Storage need.
It is tremendously CO2 intensive to build the panels.
Mm-hmm. All right. So hardware. Requires CO2. How about biofuels?
I don't know what that is. What are biofuels?
Corn. Well, it's
ethanol.
A little bit. Yeah.
Corn.
Yeah. Ethanol from corn and sugar cane are the main things, and then some kinds of plant oils can be used as diesel.
So I suppose the positive of that would be the CO2, I'm forgetting the name of it, but the technical term for it, but the burning it is also, because it's a plant and it's putting out oxygen in the atmosphere, it's this loop that happens. So you're not
right.
taking CO2 out of the ground and burning it. You're
calling
yeah.
it CO2 recycled.
Yeah.
It's renewable. Uh-huh.
Usually you need some sort of subsidies to make it economically feasible.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of true of the solar as well. Subsidies needed.
Uses up a lot of food land.
Yeah.
Yep, consumes.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it consumes food.
Doesn't it require more energy than it produces?
Sometimes, yeah.
We have the political, you know, energy. We're not dependent on other foreign sources for our fuel.
Okay.
I'm from Illinois. Not that I'm buying it, but
okay.
We're a big ethanol producer.
So, energy self-sufficiency. Then, over here, in some of the most extreme cases, people have cut down rainforest to grow sugarcane, to make biofuel. It's not a good trade-off in terms of CO2. So
depletes water tables.
Okay. Okay, so we maybe haven't made a entirely comprehensive list, but things have different trade-offs. And
is wind kind of similar to the solar in terms of the pros and
cons?
Yeah,
we haven't talked about wind. It's kind of similar.
Okay.
Some of the things I listed for that are aesthetic considerations. People don't necessarily want to be looking at windmills or huge solar panels in various places. The need for storage and a not very constant supply are in common between solar and wind.
What about tidal?
Okay. Yeah. That's
that kind
maybe
of
sort of
thing.
Sort of, yeah, tidal, I guess, is, I was thinking you sort of meant wave energy, but...
Well, yeah, like, I guess it is different.
Yeah, some people are interested
tidal.
In exploiting that, and
yeah.
I haven't thought that one out too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mean by the harnessing of tides?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so... One of the potential side effects of that is that you're actually going to change the tides. Whether that's really a negative thing, I'm not sure. Okay, some of the historical policies and trends that have led us to our current state, and this list refers more to the United States. In transportation, we have a lot of expressways and low-density zoning in the exurbs. And that means long commutes and makes mass transit impractical. And people have large housing units and they require a lot of utilities and have bigger TVs in them and more furniture and all that stuff that requires energy to produce it. Planned obsolescence, disposable stuff. You're throwing away energy every time you throw away stuff. Meat and particularly beef. Cattle produce a whole lot of the methane that is being put into the atmosphere, and just in general conspicuous consumption. And developing countries want to be like us. So if we have all these forms of conspicuous consumption, they want to get it as soon as they can. And then this is what I'm calling extrinsic costs. So effects on the environment that are brought about by the kinds of activities that we do are extrinsic costs, and so far they've basically not been represented in the balance sheet of corporations or consumers or any of these links in the economic chain. They're just sort of a global commons. And so the next part is what I'm calling incentives for reduction of emissions. And that is ways to, in some sense, roll in these extrinsic costs into activities that emit carbon. So, economic incentives for reduction. This kind is what has been more used in the United States so far, direct incentives for renewable generation, tax credits for installing solar systems and using buying more energy efficient cars. And what that does is it reduces the demand and cheapens fossil fuels, and they end up being used in some other way. So the actual effect of it may not be as large as you originally expect. Cap and trade is, I actually wish I had investigated further exactly where this exists now, but the idea behind it is to create a total quota for total emissions of CO2 per country, and that's called the cap. You have a maximum amount, and then permits for units of emissions are sold at auction, can be resold on an exchange, so that's the trade part. And the free market part of this is what encourages it to happen in the most cost-effective way. So if a company is emitting less CO2 than the permits it has allow, then it can sell some permits to someone else and create those reductions in sort of the most cost-effective way. And this assures that emissions will equal the cap, not less, because those permits are out there, and you know someone has all of them, so they're going to use them one way or another. And I believe it is already implemented in some European countries, China soon, and these can be considered test beds. There's also a U.S. nationwide voluntary trading system for these kind of permits.
California has one too.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. California too.
Yeah, it's just enacted this year, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it can be made revenue neutral by just whatever money comes in gets paid back out as a tax rebate on a per person basis. The other one is what in the book Storms of My Grandchildren by James Hansen, he says this is the one that works, not the cap and trade. Just a plain carbon tax, so it's a flat rate per unit carbon emitted, and it's likely to depend on the country. And then again, it can be made revenue neutral by rebating that amount to people. And again, it seeks the most cost-effective way to reduce the carbon emissions, but it incentivizes zero emissions. There's no cap, so again, it's a free market sort of thing, but it can pull the emissions all the way down to zero if the carbon tax is high enough. So the need for international cooperation and international governance needs to have firm goals, but be flexible enough to take advantage of lessons learned. So if your system needs some tweaking, you need to be able to do that. Emissions must be verifiable. You don't want to have too much of a black market in carbon emissions. And the USA must participate. The Kyoto Protocol was ratified in, I don't remember what year, by
98, I think.
98?
Is that something?
Yeah, I guess it didn't have the year, but the USA did not become a signatory to the Kyoto Protocol, which is an agreement for reducing carbon emissions. And that makes it basically a license for any other country to ignore it as well. So that's kind of what I've got prepared for today. So go ahead and ask questions, tell stories.
Yeah,
I'm wondering what's your, in your experience, significant experience, what you think of the idea of swapping, and by that I mean, so say that the United States decides to, you know, go all clean and we're going to have carbon tax or whatever and tax significantly the carbon emissions that we put into the air, which makes it more expensive in this country to do some kinds of engineering and some kinds of assembly.
Right.
So it's this idea that, well, if, you know, if I can buy clean energy, which is more expensive in this country, and I don't want to pay that, I can just go to, you know, I mean, somebody's going to sell me that cheap energy, which is
right.
trying to figure out where. So that's why you need this international governance in order to prevent that kind of swapping that goes on. And the same kind of thing happened in California, where California has a cap and trade program where it requires amount of CO2 neutral sources for its grid.
Mm.
And but there are people that in Oregon that are willing to sell California that power, but Oregon is building new coal power plants to power itself, really. So there are always people out there that are willing to buy the cheap power. And I think, I'm not, if you have any experience.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons why it needs to be a global system, and USA is really key to creating a global system. So in your case, it's, you know, it's California, it's not nationwide, so there are other states neighboring it. It's similar to buying a lot of imported cheap goods from other countries. It moves the labor market to other countries. Yeah, I guess I don't really have a solution.
I don't know if you guys have heard of the 350 movement, but it's basically based off of 350 parts per million, which we reached a while ago, but that's like the safe like level that we would not really have too much change in the climate. Basically, this movement is headed by Bill McKibben, who's a climate change activist, and he's working right now primarily in colleges across
the... So 350 was reached in about 1985.
And better late than never. But he's working in, with young people in colleges to get their boards of trustees to divest from fossil fuels. And there's been three schools nationwide that have divested, an art school in New York City, and a couple other schools. I know my campus has a campaign. There's lots of the small schools in Minnesota have campaigns. And even now they're also working on getting cities to divest their funds from fossil fuels. So I think in this corporate-driven world, I see the solution being in voting with their dollar and simply divesting and taking their power away from them in that way, which we know would, you know, be less, would be open avenues for other sources of energy.
Yeah, well, probably even more powerful is to stop buying their products rather than buying their stocks.
So you're telling us there's really no solution? It takes political will.
Yeah, I mean each of these renewables and nuclear probably play some sort of role, and like I said, the stabilization wedges are an optimistic scenario, but give you some guidelines for the kind of things that need to be done. Yeah, Max.
How optimistic are you about sequestration efforts and like those technologies? I don't know anything about it. Do you think it could have a profound effect in the future?
Yeah. No one's really been able to demonstrate anything that works at large scale, but there could be breakthroughs in the future. I guess let's keep our fingers crossed.
What is sequestration?
Oh, that's trapping of carbon dioxide that will take it out of the atmosphere.
Well, this is how we get fossil fuels in the first place, right? Oil, right? I mean, these are natural means of sequestering carbon.
It took hundreds of millions of years.
To do it. So I know it's, but I mean, in the natural whole process of the world, and if the world, if man hadn't intervened, perhaps those things were sequestered. And when we found these fossil fuels and took them out of sequestration, certainly it's not a solution, but really how we got, right? Because
there were carbon plant matter that was buried over a very long period of time.
And that's oil, that's peat, that's coal.
Yep.
The difficulty is not what to do with the carbon once you sequester it. It's being able to pull it out of the air at great enough quantities, right?
Right.
That's the difficulty.
Yeah. So we burned the carbon that was sequestered, and now it's up in the...
Yeah, and we can't get it back then.
Right.
Yeah, and some of the... more promising solutions are trying to sequester it right at the source. So if you've got a power plant that you can trap some of that carbon out of, that seems to be a more promising method than just putting some collection devices out to grab it out of the air.
What's your view on the smart grid and kind of that technological advancement about? Because from what I understand, we need, our existing grid as it stands right now cannot handle more than a roughly 20-25% of renewable energy, because renewable energy goes like this,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, if a cloud appears in the sky, we want to turn the lights on. So, you know, how do we kind of invest in that and change that?
Yeah. So some of the solution, I think, is by generating at home for some of the solar energy and perhaps having a switch to flip right in your house. And actually, the solar photovoltaic works most efficiently by putting it right into a DC circuit, which only works for some devices.
Hmm.
But anything that you're charging a battery on, you get way better efficiency by having a DC power source than a regular wall plug-in. So it's kind of complicated for people to put in their houses. Requires a lot of retrofitting, but that's kind of the best use of solar energy. As far as the smart grid, I'm not all that up on how that technology will push us forward.
In our area, we have smart grid in our town, or the new meters. And I think the way it'll eventually work is they know when you use electricity, and they'll, at peak times, charge you more, in essence, maybe perhaps dropping consumption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to do your laundry in the middle of the night, because your kilowatt hours or less, so it may just drive it to another time, but it may, I haven't heard this word in a long time, conservation. Remember that?
Your lifestyle change.
Your lifestyle change. That's what, and that's what the, you know, the people in our little group, no, I won't go into that.
The lifestyle change is kind of what I was getting after by calling it white people problems.
Yes. Okay, that was next. Maybe. So it seems like until something becomes really economically unfeasible, we don't do anything about it.
Yeah. What it is.
Well, I think this, also this projection assumes that the political, economic climate will be the same until 2056. I mean, the demands could reduce that, you know, serious demands made by, you know, 10% of the population.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, so you're talking about changes in, like, vehicle usage rather than just plain efficiency, huh?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, the doesn't seem like there's much momentum in our country for reducing vehicle usage, and in other countries, there's a lot more demand for it. So, actually, one of the stories I find interesting is that I guess the Prius has been out for more than a decade now, but when that was introduced in the United States and Japan, it was hailed as this great advancement, and people are going to be able to drive a car with very high gas mileage. And then when India introduced the Tata Nano, which gets the same gas mileage,
but catches on fire.
That put it, yeah, okay, that put it within reach of a whole lot of Indian people. And, you know, that's something that gives you greater CO2 emissions from that whole population. So, yeah, different vehicles, same gas mileage, but different sticker prices. And one sort of improves gas mileage on the average in one place, and the other one just introduces a whole lot more vehicles to a region.
So what do you think will, what will it take to get people to change an idea about what they think of man, what's the best way to say it? Man-made climate change?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it'll take?
Yeah, well, it'll take, I don't know, I hope it doesn't take, you know, the time between now and the death of most of those dismissive people that I talked about on Monday. Yeah, and you know, those dismissive people seem to be dead set against any kind of action. So yeah, I think, you know, we just have to have it be more evident to people, which, you know, unfortunately means we've already lost that much time to have a chance to do something about it. The longer we wait, the tougher it is to solve.
I,
we've known about it for decades already. Yeah.
I think it'll take showing and actively being in solidarity with people of disprivileged, people of the very lower class, because they're the ones who will feel the adverse effects of climate change and higher fuel prices and things first. Like in Hurricane Sandy in New York City, you know, people with money were fine, but the was it Lower East Side District or whatever it was, they were in those terrible conditions. And those are the people who will feel the real effects first before anyone else does. And as long as we kind of just stay on our high horse and don't help them out, and then wait, you know, eventually it'll come up and up and up, killing all the dismissive people along the way. But I think, you know, the sooner we show solidarity, the sooner and the better chance we have that.
Yeah, but that group of people probably need to understand that that there are consequences for them. And I think that in itself is a difficult challenge.
Right, but if they feel that, they're going to know. Like the people in New York City.
I'm not so convinced of that. If you get a hurricane, you can't attribute any one hurricane to climate change, but
they're gonna feel the price of food going up because of fuel is becoming more expensive. They'll feel that first too. I think not only hurricanes and things, but I think the adverse effects in general of running out of fuel and looking for other ways to look for fuel and energy, they'll feel. But I think that's where its change starts, is at the bottom of the socioeconomic class.
Because it seems like the people that are going to get hurt the most are the people on the fringes, people in low-lying areas of
right.
Rising.
Yeah. Right. The most marginalized.
But, so they're marginal. And
or the people who can't afford gas.
Yeah, I get it. But I mean, it's... So, I mean, I... But they don't have the political clout.
Yeah, tomorrow we're going to be talking about adaptation, and a lot of that, one of the examples we'll be using is sea level rise. How do you cope with that once it's happening, if you haven't completely prevented the effects through these means? Max?
Are there any precedents for the sort of global coordinated effort that we need to have to actually solve this problem? Has that happened on such a large scale?
I think the main precedent for it is the Montreal Protocol for that completely prohibited the manufacture of chlorofluorocarbons. So that was to eliminate the destruction of the ozone layer in the stratosphere. And that has really completely stopped the manufacture of that, and the ozone in the stratosphere is on an upward swing, and within a couple more decades should be completely restored.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Even the hole in the
Arctic? Yep.
Wow.
That offers some hope for action. When action has begun.
Not as big as this, but it is. I mean, the only other thing I can think of is World War II.
Yeah, well.
And it came together.
I guess,
want that to happen.
Yeah, people ended up not having that hard of a time finding alternatives to the CFCs. All right, just about time for Vespers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.